the new book, Secret Machines, Man, explores some pretty meaty subjects, the big questions that we all have. Are we being visited? And if so, by whom and why? There are hints about the answers to all of these, and those hints are in our own DNA. Peter Lavenda painstakingly tells the story, and it's actually a pretty exciting story of scientific discovery. It brings a lot of threads together, seemingly disparate pieces of information. We're going to jump into that next, and later we'll open up the phone lines to take your calls and questions. So bring your A game, folks. We'll be right back. Peter, the discussion of DNA and its relationship to these questions is really kind of the heart of this book. And I know that might sound stuffy and scientific, but it's really, it's like a scientific adventure story as you tell it. It's really, really, I enjoyed it the heck out of it. I wonder if you could just take a couple of minutes and walk us through some of the highlights.
Sure. It is something that's fascinated me for decades. The whole study of genetics and DNA and RNA and that whole thing has just been endlessly fascinating to me as well. I'm glad you saw it the same way. I start off the book, this volume two, with a quotation from Richard Dawkins. Now, Richard Dawkins, of course, is a famous author, scientific author of books about science, and famously an atheist. And the quotation that I like is when he says, quote, "We are survival machines, robot vehicles, blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. This is a truth which still fills me with astonishment," unquote. And that's from his book, The Selfish Gene. He was impressed, and I think a lot of scientists and lay people alike have been totally impressed by the fact that we seem to be machines for DNA to reproduce itself. It's as if the DNA molecule itself only cares about creating more DNA. And what happens to us individually after we've procreated is of virtually no interest to the DNA molecule. And the molecule itself was only really identified and diagrammed, if you will, in the middle of the last century, the 20th century, by Francis Crick, Watson, and a number of other people. And Francis Crick won the Nobel Prize for that. Crick, who discovered the DNA molecule and described its function and its appearance and all of that, was of the opinion that there was no way that that molecule, which is present in every living thing on the planet, plants, animals, people, everything, that that molecule could have spontaneously just showed up on its own on the planet. It seemed to him impossible that, you know, it would have evolved from the gases and the waters and everything else that existed on the planet, that that complex mechanism of those four amino acids with combining in the codons to create the genes, et cetera, this entire process would have been just spontaneously happened. It began to evolve over a period of millions of years, the millions of years that we know the planet was in existence. It didn't make any sense to him. And he felt that it had to have come from somewhere else. It was a doctrine called panspermia, that the seeds came from elsewhere. But he went one step further. Not only did he say that the DNA, or basically the RNA molecule, which then creates the DNA molecule, that the RNA molecule not only was seeded from somewhere else, it was specifically planted here, a theory he called directed panspermia, which implies that there was a purpose, an intention, and therefore an intelligence behind seeding this planet with the RNA molecule, which would then, like seeds, would propagate all over the place and create the abundance of life that we have on the planet. So he came up with that idea, and that's the guy who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the DNA molecule. He was not some wide-eyed, you know, theorist just making stuff up. This is a guy who was hands-on with this. And shortly thereafter, I mean, 30, 40 years later, people began looking at the DNA molecule and the genetic structure from a different perspective, a purely mathematical one, because the DNA molecule is basically just four acids. And it's the combination of these four letters, let's call them, that creates all the words of the genetic alphabet, which is vast. So these researchers in Kazakhstan looked at the DNA molecule and said to themselves, there's something fishy here, because the DNA molecule has what are known as stop codes. So some codons, combinations of those acids into a codon, some specific ones of these codons do nothing except separate one gene from the next gene. And a gene could be, you know, hundreds or thousands of codons in a row. But then suddenly it comes to a stop, and there's this stop codon that separates one gene from the next, like a space between words, or perhaps like punctuation of some kind. And they said, well, how is that even possible? How is it possible for one of these codons to exist, to have been created specifically for no other purpose than to divide two other genes? So they did further analysis, and what they came up with, and I discuss this in the book, is that they realized that that codon is the equivalent of zero in mathematics. In other words, it's a placeholder that breaks up one string of numbers from another string of numbers. It's actually a zero. And their rather stunning realization was that zero does not exist in nature.
Oh, man.
You know, we had to come up with zero ourselves as humans in order to get to the more advanced mathematics. If you realize Roman numerals don't have zero, for instance, they're just a bunch of letters that equal numbers, and you just keep adding on to them. So, you know, MM is the year 2000, because an M is 1,000 and two M's means 2,000. There's no two with three zeros in Roman numerals or in any of the ancient systems of numbers, numerological systems. Zero was invented kind of maybe simultaneously in India and in Mexico, countries that were fascinated with astronomy and trying to figure out, calculate the motions of the planets and the stars. It may have been a result of that. But whatever the result is, if zero doesn't exist in nature, but it does exist in the DNA molecule, and if the DNA molecule was, as Francis Crick theorized, seeded here from somewhere else, that implies a whole other kind of history of our planet, which we have to come to grips with. We have to somehow figure out, because that means that somehow the DNA molecule was created artificially, was created by some other race, maybe something, so a race that looks kind of like us, possibly, and then was seeded on this planet, and they sat back and watched it to see what would happen. It's a lot of very fascinating history about the DNA molecule in the book. You can see all of this in more detail and see, you know, the sources for it. I source everything. I'm not just making stuff up here. And these are scientific papers that are cited. And this is a very exciting, but a very weird and relatively astonishing result of the research I was doing on genetics.
There's a visual component to this, too, where you found throughout human history other places and examples where this DNA symbol, the double helix thing, shows up in different guises.
Yeah, and that's the other scary thing, because the double helix also does not exist in nature. The helix does. You can think of a snake, a serpent twining around a staff, the famous symbol of the caduceus. But nowhere there are spirals everywhere in plants, in organs and animals and everything else, but there is no double helix. And yet you'll find the double helix in ancient China, in ancient Egypt, and in Sumer and Babylon, and in the American continents as well. You'll find that double helix symbol repeated a lot. And there's a famous Chinese illustration that I use in the book that shows the creator is the father and mother of all humanity, two Chinese gods, a god and a goddess. And their tails form a double helix around itself. And it's just stunning to me, because this is supposed to be the progenitors, the origin of the human race. And it's depicted again as a double helix, which, you know, from the date of that illustration, hundreds of years ago, long before Francis Crick was able, with microscopes and all the technology at his disposal, to realize that that was the structure of the DNA molecule.
I think the term it's used in the book is biological SETI, this research, the biological SETI conclusion. And And it has been used. I think the argument has been used in support of intelligent design by people who want intelligent design taught in schools. And I've had this argument with people about, well, be careful what you wish for, because the intelligent designer may not be the entity you expect.
Exactly, precisely. You may lead us down a completely different rabbit hole. You may not want to go there.
And so it's only a little bit of a leap from that discussion to the idea that the designers are still tinkering with what they manufactured.
Well, possibly. If we look once again at the example of the small grays and what they seem to be up to, the contactees are, you know, report a lot of different sort of biological intrusions or surgical intrusions by these visitors, right? They seem, whoever these visitors are, they seem inordinately concerned with how our biology works and how reproduction takes place. I think that the fact that that is a major form of interest to a psychiatrist, it would say it says more about us than about them, that these are the impressions that we're getting. But if we take the experiences of the experiencers and the contactees seriously for a second and just look at it and look at them as if this is something that's actually happened or something that's perceived to have happened, what could possibly be the reason? And the reason may be that we are self-replicating machines. As Richard Dawkins mentioned, as I said at the top of this segment, he said that we're basically robot vehicles for the DNA. If we are self-replicating machines, perhaps the machines that are investigating us do not self-replicate. And perhaps this is something that they're fascinated by. This is a technology that they don't understand because maybe they have to be created one by one. I'm just throwing out a theory. But the reason I'm throwing out these theories and the reason that Book 2 is full of this is because I want other people to come up with more and better questions, not necessarily the answers yet, but to come up with more and better questions about this, to look at this and to look at their own experiences in their own lives, whether it's in science or whether it's in any aspect, any human endeavor, and say to themselves, how can I use what I know as a way of understanding the visitors, way of understanding the phenomenon, a way of understanding these machines, for instance, or the saucers, if you want to call them that. How can I use what I do in my daily life and what I've learned in my life to understand this? Because there's going to come a point in time when we're going to need everybody involved in this. We don't have the intellectual resources on our own to do this. We're going to need everybody's cooperation. So by bringing up these questions in Secret Machines Man, I'm basically trying to inspire a lot of people to start asking questions, to disagree with me for sure, but to come up with different ideas and different ways of approaching the same information and do it science-based if possible, you know, and if not possible, if you're an artist, if you're a musician, do it based upon what you know, but be honest about it, and maybe we'll get to a deeper and better understanding of what these things are.
In your discussion and exploration of the DNA issues, you get into the idea of, I'll use this term, but it doesn't really fit, planned obsolescence, how we're not exactly designed to die, but we're also not designed to live forever. Although there is something in us, as you note, that seems to strive for immortality. There's an incongruence there that's at the heart of a lot of human problems, strife and war and our unhappiness with our surroundings and our willingness to change our surroundings at all times.
Well, exactly. And I think this is the crux of the human condition. I think this is really explains everything about us, and it helps explain consciousness. We as human individuals, we don't want to die. You know, we've been pursuing immortality since as long as there's been a recorded human history. Immortality has been a goal. Everyone knows that their lives are too short. They want to live, if not forever, they want to live for hundreds and hundreds of years. The DNA molecule, though, definitely does not want that to happen. And the reason is they don't want people to live too long to consume resources that would be better used by another generation, a new iteration of the DNA molecule. Every time another child is born, that's a new iteration of the DNA molecule. It's a combination of the DNA of the two parents. And it creates a different kind of DNA, which it then uses to reproduce, et cetera, et cetera. The DNA wants to keep reproducing. The DNA molecule is itself immortal, unless the planet blows up and all the DNA is destroyed. the DNA will live forever. It will keep reproducing. We will die off as individuals, but the DNA will live forever. We are resistant to that, you know. We want to be able to say we can live as long as we like. The DNA is fighting us on this, and I think that's what Richard Dawkins was talking about, too. He called his book The Selfish Gene. The gene wants to live. Wants us to die. It wants itself to live. The gene wants to live forever. But our consciousness is a whole different ballgame. And the struggle between consciousness and genetics may be at the heart of everything that we experience as alienation on this planet. We see a planet of extreme beauty and extreme ugliness at the same time. We are constantly at war with ourselves, and this may be the reason why. We're at war, basically, with our actual genetic inheritance, and maybe our consciousness comes from elsewhere.
It's as if we were designed to replicate DNA for the next generation, and as you note, that, you know, if we lived forever, we'd be taking up resources that would be taken away from that next generation. It makes you wonder if they showed up in force in the 40s and 50s when world population was so high, when threats to the planet and resources were great, and whether that's a factor in seemingly the increasing numbers of these things and encounters that have been reported.
Well, another possibility too, and that's one of them for sure, is that for the first time in the 20th century, we actually went into their element. We were not able to fly until the Wright brothers. So basically, we've been, you know, bound to the earth, and we haven't been able to plunge to the depths of the oceans either until we invented submarines that could do that. So suddenly, we're in their neighborhood, right? We're in the sky all the time. We're sending rockets to the moon, and we're sending satellites out. Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are still out there. We are, you know, we're in their space now. Literally and figuratively, we're in their neighborhood, and it may be that this is catching their attention more and more, that the areas they thought they were safe in, which is the upper atmosphere and the depths of the oceans, are now becoming, in a sense, populated. We're encroaching or invading, in a sense, their part of the world, and getting their attention, and they're feeling pressure from us, or perhaps they're seeing that in the future there's going to be more of us out there. And it's maybe causing consternation. I'm projecting a human reaction onto these things, which may not have human reactions at all and may be ignoring us for the most part, but just as a way of opening the conversation. Perhaps it's the fact that we started flying that got their attention even more.
You know, the argument has been made about alien abductions. These beings seem so advanced they can come presumably from far, far away. Surely they wouldn't need to abduct us in order to carry out experiments and things and replicate our DNA or bodily fluids or whatever the heck they want out of us. What do you say to that?
Unless they're machines.
Yeah.
And the machines have been programmed to do what they're doing. You know, with some sort of artificial intelligence program has, you know, when faced with a certain set, with a certain formula, a certain set of conditions, if A plus B happens, then you have to go to C and D. It could be something as simple as that. We may be just projecting our ideas of what they should be able to do or not able to do onto them, like saying they couldn't possibly be from another planet because, you know, the spacecraft would take too long to get here, et cetera, et cetera. There's light years, you know, involved. Maybe that's not. Maybe we're projecting our own science onto them. Are they more advanced than us scientifically, or are they other advanced, not more advanced, but they have a different technology that's not necessarily greater than ours or a natural evolution of our technology, but a technology that takes into consideration a completely different set of parameters that we don't know, we don't understand yet about physics, the relationship between Newtonian physics, for instance, and quantum mechanics, you know, that kind of problem that we still have. We still can't translate one into the other effectively. We still can't explain one with the other effectively.
We're talking with Peter Lavenda, Secret Machines, Man, Volume 2. We're talking with Peter Lavenda about his massive project, Secret Machines. This is Volume 2, Man, which explores some pretty provocative, profound ideas, including the idea that DNA was manufactured by someone on purpose, and that Earth was seeded on purpose. and that maybe whoever did that is still around interacting with us on multiple levels. We're going to open up the phone lines in just a minute. Then at the top of the hour, I'll be joined by the young guns of ufology, Danny Silva and Joe Merja. Stick around. We'll be right back. Peter Lavenda, at the beginning of our conversation, you had mentioned that, you know, soon we may not be able to tell the difference between us and them, that we're pursuing these secret machines. We're trying to build our own Tic Tacs and gimbals and figure out anti-gravity. I know that the organization TTSA that you work with, or the group that you work with, has metamaterials. There are stories that we've seen about bits and pieces of technology that have been acquired over the many years around the planet. We're trying to figure it out. We're trying to become them, to do what they do. And I'll tell you, if I were them, I wouldn't let us. I don't think I'd let us get that far.
I'm with you on that one. But it looks like we're inexorably heading in that direction unless something really serious happens to stop the progress that, you know, we've made so far. We are going, you know, full blazes ahead on developing the next iteration of AI, the next version of it, and the whole convergence idea of all of the stuff coming together to create a completely new type of reality. I think that, you know, it may be like Pogo, we've met the enemy and they are us. We may be getting to that point. It's going to be harder and harder to tell us from them, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to build, you know, we're trying to build saucers, basically. We're trying to create androids that will be indistinguishable from human beings and have intelligence that would be indistinguishable from human beings, which, you know, asks the question then, you know, will they have consciousness? And if so, if they do have consciousness, will we be able to control these artificially created human beings? And once we ask that question, the next question, obviously, is, are we artificially created human beings? I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if they came here, it was a long time ago. They're sent out, like, if they're machines, they're international harvesters here to take care of the crop and service it once in a while and until it gets to where it needs to be. They've been hiding among us, and they check in now and then. But now we're getting to the point where we can find them, and I don't know if they're programmed to deal with that.
Well, one of the criticisms that's been leveled at To the Stars Academy has been that they see the membership there as being fear mongers, you know, as going around saying, oh, you know, we're going to be invaded at any moment, and these things are hostile, they're going to kill us. This is the problem, though, is that we're projecting this. What the people at To the Stars are saying is, we have to ask these questions. I mean, to be responsible, and to be responsible people in science and defense and intelligence, in academia, in all of these fields, to be responsible, we have to ask the question, are these things a threat? Whether intentionally, as in, you know, the evil space aliens coming to invade us, or unintentionally as a kind of force of nature that just made, you know, accidentally or, you know, by some other means crush us, you know, for some reason, the way we would step on an anthill. We need to know these things. We need to ask these questions, and that's what these guys are doing. They're asking the questions. That doesn't mean that we're saying we're on the verge of, you know, of an invasion or something, and I wanted to put that to rest right away. These guys are trained, and they're all guys for the most part, are trained to think in terms of the military and in terms of military threats, and that's why they got the funding, you know, to do this kind of research, because we fund Defense Department stuff. We fund military projects more than we fund academic research. So they're the guys who got the money, right? So they're looking at it. Is this a threat or is it not a threat? And if so, how do we define it? So, yeah, we have to ask these questions. That doesn't mean that's what's going on. That doesn't mean that we're in imminent danger. But by the same token, we have to ask the questions. We have to know what's going on. We have to figure out why these things seem to turn on and off missile bases. You know, is this deliberate? Are they trying to send us a message? You know, if they were humans like us, that's exactly what they would be doing. They would be toying with us or giving us a warning. Don't color outside the lines, you know. But if they're like, not human, then yeah. What does it mean?
It's like the alien editorials that you hear over the years, you know, not centuries, but decades of contactee reports. I had this woman from Venus who told me you need to stop blowing up the planet. You need to take care of it.
Right.
They lecture us, but they haven't.
The prophets never tell us, guys, you're doing a great job. Keep it up. Why does that never happen? Not since biblical times until now. The prophets are always telling us, "You're about to do. You're blowing it, guys. You're blowing it. You know, you got to straighten out." They've always been telling us that, haven't they? They've never come off and said, "You know, you're doing the right thing. Keep doing what you're doing. We'll check back with you in 100 years."
You wrote in this book early in the book about ATIP, that the story about ATIP and the other program OSAP, that coming out might be a tipping point. What do you mean by that?
It's changed everything. And for somebody like me, I was born in 1950, right? So I've been through the mill with the Cold War and Vietnam and the assassinations and all the rest of it. I've seen the ups and downs and horrible things going on around the planet. And in all that, almost 70 years now, the subject of UFOs has been taboo in polite society. The tipping point that we need desperately is for our academics, the people who really could solve this problem and answer it for us and come up with ways and new paradigms to address it, have not been doing it until now. This is giving them a way to do it. This is saying, okay, people are taking this seriously. Serious people are taking it seriously. We now can start to do the same. And you've been seeing it. You've been seeing it on cable news shows. You've been seeing it, as you mentioned at the top of this show, in the press, in the media, everywhere. People are talking about this now, and they're not laughing. And that was the tipping point that we needed. This is what Tom wanted to accomplish. This is what we all did back 5 years ago when this thing started, was to put this thing out there in a way that people could discuss this seriously, soberly, and come up with some solutions.
You know, it seems like the Pentagon is really struggling with dealing with this. There are elements in there that are not happy that this came
Absolutely.
Out. You see these
There's
stories plant. Yeah, go ahead.
There's two reasons for it. One reason is, there's one group within the Pentagon, and it's within society in general, but in the Pentagon as well, that thinks anything to do with UFOs and aliens and the phenomenon in general is demonic. Okay, they have this really a very narrow religious fundamentalist approach to this, and you're not supposed to deal with this. You're supposed to ignore it. That's one group of people. The other group feels that they don't, since they don't have an adequate answer for this, it questions their authority. It questions their ability to protect the nation, to defend the nation. It's a question of sovereignty. Sovereignty of a country depends upon its ability to defend its citizens from external threats or internal threats, as the case may be. If we don't know how to defend ourselves against this, there are people in the Pentagon who are going to say, let's not even talk about it until we really know what we're talking about. So they don't want this to get out. They never did. Right? But it's coming out anyway, because the weight of the fact that we all now have technology at our fingertips that enables us to record things, to tape things, to take photographs of things at a moment's notice, which we didn't have before, and then to share it with billions of other people, this is also pushing this in that direction.
Let's take a call or two. West of the Rockies, Rick in San Francisco. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Yes, thank you.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Peter LaVenda, Whitney Strieber was on earlier this week, and he kind of referred to you as a CIA agent, and I thought that sounded kind of unfair. I mean, even if you did some, you were an analyst or something, I don't know what he meant by it exactly. Any response to that? Or
yeah, that's pretty interesting. I just heard about this a couple of days ago. Somebody called my attention to it, and I thought it was kind of funny. I don't know if Whitley was making a joke where that's concerned. I think he knows me better than that. But no, I've not now, nor have I ever been in the intelligence community in any way, shape, or form of any kind. But I have known people, obviously, who are in CIA and in FBI and in other, you know, groups. I mean, I've been around. I've done a lot of international travel, and I've done a lot of stuff. So you come across people, and you know people, and I've worked with one particular agent, former agent, in an export-import office in New York once. I mean, you come across people who are in the agency, but I've never worked for them, never, you know, got a paycheck from them. I've never been an informant or anything else for the CIA. So the people are, you know, will jump to that conclusion because of the people involved with To the Stars, and they're going to come away with thinking the whole group is a CIA front, which is pretty funny. So, you know, I understand where that's coming from, and I'm very open about the fact that I'm a member of the Association of Former Intelligence Officers, AFIO, and anybody who's an American citizen and who pays, you know, there's an annual fee, an annual dues, can join AFIO just like I did. And I do it because I get to talk to people who can tell me things. So I can talk to people who are in the FBI, the NSA, the CIA, all these different groups, all the alphabet soup. And you can hear firsthand from them about their lives and the way they dealt with government bureaucracies and the way they dealt with things, whatever they can tell me without you know, disclosing any classified stuff. That's what I do. I'm a writer and a researcher. So I've researched a lot of people. I've met terrorists. I've met Nazis, neo-Nazis, Klansmen, Satanists, all kinds of interesting people as part of my work, as part of my research. So,
thanks for the call, Rick.
Yeah, people will jump to conclusions.
And, you know, it's same thing with ATIP. So the ATIP story is out. Well, it's disinformation. Clearly, it's meant to be a diversion. It's something the Pentagon planted, and you guys are crazy enough to fall for it. Or that comes from ufologists, purists, I guess, who don't want it to be true.
Right. Yeah. I get that. I understand it, and I get it, and I sympathize. But all I can do is say, we're not out to get anybody. I'm not out to get anybody. TTSA isn't. You know, this is not what this is about. This is not a partisan thing where we're looking to, you know, supplant anybody or take away their demographic or anything else. We just want to do our thing here and get this stuff out.
We'll go to Michael in Virginia Beach on the wildcard line. Hi, Michael.
Thank you so much, George. George, I'm thinking about what Peter Levendis said. With regard to the black-eyed, large black-eyed grays. Here's the problem that I have as someone who talks to former intelligence officers. The problem is this. When these grays are being brought into reality by hypnotists who have their own agenda, hypnotists who can somehow discover these grays in the mind of a person who can't discover it for themselves, hypnotists who tell us they can go back into thousands of previous lifetimes by somebody that they've hypnotized, the whole thing falls apart as a farce. Now,
hey, Michael, I don't mean to interrupt your lecture, but can we get to a question for my guest?
Yeah. He talked about the Samaritans. He talked about the ancient Chinese and the double helix appearing in their literature. Does he consider anything about the prophet Moses to be actual history?
Okay, let's find out.
Okay, that's a little bit above my pay grade, but I could say that there's been a lot of controversy and debate over whether or not Moses was an actual historical figure or whether the Exodus happened when everybody thought it happened. But there's been, you know, historical research since then which suggests that something like the Exodus happened, but whether Moses was an Egyptian priest or whether Moses was a corruption of an Egyptian, where we can go into this in a lot of detail. As I said, it's above my pay grade. I can't come down on that issue one side or the other. I've seen a lot of, you know, controversial statements made by very competent archaeologists and biblical scholars on both sides of that issue.
Well, there is a larger issue of whether some of the events that have happened in the Bible and other religious texts and traditions were some kind of God event or an alien event that are interpreted in different ways.
Sure. Or, you know, or is there a difference?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The question about hypnosis that Michael raised, of course, that's a legitimate criticism in some cases when people are retrieving memories about these alien abductions. But there are a heck of a lot of cases where people don't need hypnosis to recall the events.
That's right. Exactly.
All right. Let's try to get one more call in. Charles in Texas. Hi, Charles.
Hi. Peter, And thank you for taking my call. Peter, I wonder if you're aware of any kinds of programs where they have been researching or trying to find people whose genetics make them a bit more able to access some of the technology that they may be able to find. And the reason why I ask this partly is because of people I have known that told me about programs like this, but also because I was approached myself, I don't know, I guess it's a few years ago now, but to access some of this technology, because supposedly I had some of this kind of genetics, a little bit more than just DNA, as one professor I know would tell me. But and also I noticed that in your Tiki, your To the Stars Academy, that you have a Dr. Rapp, which is interesting, actually.
Hey, Charles. Yeah. Charles, we're running out of time here, so.
Have you heard of any programs like that? And if not, have you considered looking in to see if they're looking into any of those kind of programs? They might be.
All right, thank you, Charles. Appreciate the call. Maybe the question should be, he was interested in the genetics. Have you seen evidence that the abduction experiences follow genetic lines?
Well, I haven't seen that that evidence, but what I do know is that people who have been affiliated with To the Stars are very interested to see if there's genetic changes in abductees, and people who've claimed contactee or abductee experiences. Has their genetic code been altered in some way? Were they in the presence of a mutating kind of force or something that would have changed their DNA in some way? And that research, I know, is ongoing. And this is by reputable, you know, scientists who are talking to people who claim or have been more or less proven to have had these contactee or abductee experiences. So there's a genetic component to this, and it's being taken very seriously.
Peter Lavenda, thanks very much. Secret Machines, Gods, Man, and War, Volume 2. Great work. It's certainly a lot to think about. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, George, and happy 30th anniversary.
See you later. Coming up next, the young guns of ufology, Danny Silva and Joe Mergia. We'll be right back.